From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, writer Kristen Hanna talks about The Nightingale, her novel of women in the French Resistance during World War II.
You're living through it day by day, and you have to make a series of decisions, some of which feel monumental at the time and some of which feel less monumental. And you don't really know until history plays out.
Then the difference a four-legged furry concierge can make for guests at a Milwaukee hotel.
So it is a hotel, but for some people it's given them that little touch of home, so to speak, that it has an identity now more than just this big hotel between 5th and 6th Streets off of Wisconsin.
Author Marnie Mominga and her husband find themselves with a flat tire in the North Woods of Wisconsin and find they have to actually read the owner's manual.
And we'll have the latest edition of our storytelling series, Exfabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next. News is first. Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. It's been nearly 72 years since the end of World War II. The youngest veterans of that war are entering into their 90s. And in the time since, history books, movies, and novels have told the story of the war from many different angles. And yet, there are still many stories we haven't heard.
And that was part of the reason for the success of Kristen Hanna's 2015 novel, The Nightingale. It told the story of two regular women, sisters, Vianne and Isabelle, who lived through World War II and occupied France. And although they were both involved in resisting the occupation, their lives were much different. But we'll stop there to avoid any spoilers.
The best-selling book came out this year in paperback, and Kristen Hanna visited us in the studio. Welcome to Milwaukee and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Is there a message from The Nightingale that you see as especially relevant today, 75 years after World War II versus any other time since then?
You know, it is really interesting. I think one of the reasons that The Nightingale has sort of been so embraced by people and is so beloved by people is it really is sort of an examination of war and intolerance and sort of how people survive under those kinds of conditions. And I do think that the world right now is an increasingly dangerous, or it feels increasingly dangerous and unstable. And I think that a lot of people want to be and are pleased to be sort of reminded of the lessons of World War II.
Right. There are a lot of decisions that take place in this book involving life and death, good and bad, and the kind of gray area in between all of those. And most of us don't necessarily have those kinds of decisions to make every day. But do you think when we're thinking of those questions about what an ordinary person would do in extraordinary times, are we really thinking war, life and death, or is there maybe something more basic playing out in our head?
Well, first of all, I think that's one of the reasons that World War II fiction is so gripping for people and why we respond to it on such a visceral level, because the stakes are so high. It's so clearly good versus evil. And there just aren't that many times in the modern world where we can see that. And, you know, however, the difference is when it comes down to – it's easy to see that in retrospect. But what I was trying to show is you're living through it day by day, and you have to make a series of decisions, some of which feel monumental at the time and some of which feel less monumental. And you don't really know until history plays out what those decisions are going to mean to you and your family. And my big question here, and the reason I wrote this book, was sort of this idea of if an ordinary woman, you know, finds herself in this extraordinarily dangerous situation and she's trying to either keep her children alive or you know, work towards her country's future, you know, when do you make this decision to risk your own life or your child's life for a stranger? And I think that's really the crux of you know, sort of the heart of the book.
What did it take for you to wrap your head around the micro parts of this narrative? You know, as you say, the good versus evil, right. You know, war versus peace narrative is really easy for us to grasp. But these little decisions are not something that necessarily are what we typically learn about as we learn about World War II.
Well, and that was really what I was most interested in. It sort of falls into this pet peeve of mine, which is the loss of women's history particularly, and how so much of history is by men about men. And what I found really fascinating is that there aren't as many explorations of what the women were doing and, you know, what their choices were. And so what I tried to do was to take this world that we all think we know and to really make it an ordinary world for an ordinary woman and sort of show you, you know, yes, you hear, for example, that under the occupation there was very little food. I wanted you to know what that felt like and what decisions you made and how it impacted your family. And I really wanted a reader to be able to put themselves in these women's shoes because I think that's how the lessons reverberate the most strongly if you can see yourself in that situation.
There was an article, I think it was last fall, in the New York Times about the popularity of World War II historical fiction among young adult readers today. And obviously your book is for an adult audience, but one of the debates the characters in The Nightingale have is just about how to remember this time or even if they should mm-hmm. remember this time. And I'm curious how you wrangled with that question as you wrote it.
Well, it's, you know, one of the things I found in my research in talking to survivors and talking to historians, you know, in doing the research necessary was, you know, that a lot of World War II survivors and women in particular came home and didn't talk about this with their families and didn't write down their memoirs and didn't, you know, tell their stories. And so I think a lot of it has been semi-lost. And I think it's really important to sort of, you know, be this reminder. And one of the things I've loved most about the reaction to the book is the millennial and young adult, you know, response to it, because I think they are just one more generation removed from this and it's not as much a part of their lives. And I think The Nightingale is really helping them understand what their grandparents went through
or their great-grandparents,
yeah. Right.
Was there something that you expressly wanted to guard against when you wrote The Nightingale?
Well, the big fear, of course, when you take on World War II, I mean, I'm not a historian. I'm not a scholar. I haven't dedicated years of my life to the study of this. And so the risk was twofold. First was the risk of being cliche, you know, of trotting on territory that had already been done a lot of times. And the second, of course, was to be wrong, you know. And so these two were the things that drove me. But what I really sort of understood the deeper I went in my research was the cliche issue wasn't the problem I expected it to be, because so little about women has been written. And so, yes, we know about the battles, we know about the big sweeps, we know about the big changes, but sort of life in a village or, you know, the helping of downed airmen has been less explored from the female perspective. And so that really helped out quite a bit.
Right. The cliche would be the Casablanca, Ingrid Bergman, you have to be brave for both of us.
Exactly. I mean, and anything, just the kinds of scenes we've seen a lot of times in films and in books. And so I wanted to steer clear of sort of the big moments of the war and really focus on the intimate human moments.
What about the second part, the part about being wrong? I mean, the book has been out for more than 2 years at this point, mm-hmm. and I gather you have met any number of people who this is, you know, part of their family story. Do you have any trepidation when someone comes up to you and says, my mom or my grandmother was part of the French Resistance?
You know, I'm always just a little bit nervous. And I think like all authors, you have this fear that you're suddenly going to be unmasked, that there was the one book you didn't read or that you were fundamentally wrong in some ways. I had a lot of people read for that. So, I felt as comfortable as I could. But with regard to meeting survivors. I mean, they've been coming to my book signings now for a couple of years, and it is the most remarkable and humbling thing. And in fact, I had one woman come up. She was 90-some years old, and she said that she was Isabel's age, and that her family, she was living in France at the time, of course, and her family had been asking her, what was it like in France? And she said she'd never been able to tell them. And now she was handing them copies of the book and saying, this is what it was like.
Well, and there are parts of Isabel's story that are adventurous and even exciting, but I would imagine you would want to be careful not to over-romanticize or glamorize it, too.
Well, and she was by far the easier character to write because she was so adventurous. She did sort of jump in with both feet. She was inspired by a woman named André de Jong, who a Belgian, 19-year-old Belgian woman, who started one of the first escape routes out of France. And what was amazing to me was I almost felt in reading André's story and every woman's story, you couldn't romanticize it too much because it was all true. I mean, the fear was there, the danger was there, the courage was there, the repercussions were there. And so really it was a lot more about feeling honest and down to earth as opposed to superhero-ish.
Right. It has, as we said, been more than 2 years since The Nightingale was first published, and I don't know how long since you began writing it. Did you have a sense as you were writing it that it would be something special even within your 22nd novel, I think, right?
You know, it's funny. Yeah. I mean, I've written a lot of books, and I knew when I sort of came up with the story and did the research that it was a potential powerhouse for somebody. And I was hoping that somebody else would write it so that I could just sit on the beach and read it. But since that didn't happen and I was forced to sort of jump in, once I got into it and once I got past the fear of writing a historical novel and taking on such a beloved topic, I really did get the sense that it had the potential to be special. I thought it was powerful, you know. And then when the read started coming in from agents and editors and, you know, other authors, I thought, okay, this really has a chance. Never in my wildest dreams did I imagine the level of success that it's had. But yeah, I felt it was a special book.
Feel like it raises the bar?
I feel like I should retire right now, let's face it.
So I read something that jumped out at me in getting ready for this interview. You write in longhand.
I do. I still write longhand on yellow legal pads like from my lawyer days.
Well, so what do you think writing with pen and paper does for you that you would not get from sitting down with your laptop to draft a novel?
You know, it's two things. Most importantly is there's no delete key. And a blue screen, you know, I can write a sentence and think, that's not a very good sentence. Let's delete it and start over. I can do that for literally quite some period of time. Once I've written it on paper, it's just too much trouble to start over or cross out. So I just keep going. So what that does is it allows me to reach a level of sort of flow, and it sort of inhibits the self-editor. So that's the first thing. And then secondly, I found that I can write, and I love writing, for hours at a time, and I can't sit in a chair at a computer that long.
Well, and at some level, I imagine the editorial process continues to play out as you go from the handwritten to the typewritten.
Yeah. It gets entered into the computer, and then I still do, for the first, like, 8 or 9 drafts, I still do all my additions on yellow pads and just insert them like I used to in the law days. But then there does come a point when I begin doing all my work on the computer, and I can use a computer. I just don't write on it.
And there's no medium step where you work on a typewriter for a while.
No typewriter.
Well, I hope I said it enough. It's a terrific novel. And Kristen Hanna, thank you so much for spending
some
time with us.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciated being here.
Kristen Hanna is the author of more than 20 books, the latest of which is the internationally best-selling The Nightingale, which is recently out in paperback. She visited Milwaukee in May for a talk at the Elm Grove Women's Club, and she joined us then.
Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment. We'll meet a somewhat unusual concierge plying her trade at a downtown Milwaukee hotel. We will meet her and her human next on Lake Effect Weekend.
Always.
Lake Effect Weekend continues now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. What separates a great hotel from a pretty good one? A comfortable mattress, a clean room, maybe a spiffy bathrobe or a fine restaurant, but above all, memorable service. Well, the Milwaukee Hilton City Center Hotel has a staff member that will make even the fussiest guest pause.
Millie is the hotel's canine concierge, a mini golden doodle who works with her owner, Rusty Daler, a human concierge, 5 days a week. In May, Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski took a walk up Wisconsin Avenue to the Hilton to meet with its newest and shortest staff member.
Rusty Daler and Millie, welcome to Lake Effect. Thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for coming. Yeah.
So Millie is an adorable golden doodle puppy sitting on a couch with us. But to start, what's her story? How did you come to be her owner, and how did she come to Milwaukee and be a puppy concierge?
Well, the talk was probably last summer or early fall. The mention was made of having a hotel dog. And I was really curious when I heard the conversation. So I approached the manager and asked him, like, what are you thinking about? And he said, yeah, we might want to get a hotel dog. And at the time, he wanted like to find a rescue, and having had dogs my whole life, knowing that I've raised golden retrievers for the past 20 years, I knew that finding a dog for a hotel in a very specific job sort of demanded you look for a specific kind of dog. Mm-hmm. Like, so being partial to Goldens, I started looking at Goldens, but then the shedding, I knew that would be hard for a hotel. And then the doodles. And then I found a gentleman in Indiana who breeds Goldens, but also mini Goldens. So her mother is a golden retriever, but her father is a toy poodle. Don't ask. I don't want to know. Everybody asks me. I don't know. I don't know how this works.
So she'll stay about that size?
Yeah, she's about, she's about 20 pounds. She has shorter legs. I keep contact with several of her siblings who are much bigger. So you never really know for sure in, you know, big breeds what they're going to be. But I think she's on the smaller end of the spectrum. But the non-shedding is wonderful for the hotel. And, you know, people with allergies, although she's not totally hypoallergenic, because her mom was a golden, she still is pretty much so. I mean, I don't notice hair or... At home, she can ruffle around on the couch or the bed, and there's nothing there, so that makes it really nice.
That's good. Who came up with the name Millie?
That would be me. So I was thinking, like, how do I encompass more than just the hotel, or what name can I figure to put that together? I didn't like the name Milwaukee, per se, but then it starts and the end, and I sort of was playing with it, and then I came up with Millie, because the beginning of the word and the end sort of connects, so that's where I came up with it.
Yeah. So you mentioned that the hotel first talked about bringing on a dog. Mm-hmm. So is that something that more hotels are looking at, or was it just unique to the Hilton as an idea to have another aspect for the guest experience?
Yeah, I think it's unique to us in this case, but I sort of became aware of dogs in hotels actually through the Kimpton. They have guest pet relation kind of dogs at some of their hotels. That was my first inkling that other hotels were doing it. I've since come across little places, a friend in Boston, there's a hotel there that has a dog in the lobby. And so they're there, but I think just not as prevalent. And so in a big hotel like this, they're usually in smaller, like boutique hotels. This is a difference that she's in such a large venue.
Right, I often think of like Eloise at the Plaza, or when I'm watching Curious George with my niece, there's a little dog named Hudley who's the doorman's dog. So how do you see Millie's role in Milwaukee? And, you know, we have Hank for the Brewers, but we don't have a ton of animals affiliated with what's going on here. So what's your hope with keeping her here and established?
You know, it's caught me a little off guard, because I was really not thinking that it would be that big of a deal. Like, you know, I wasn't really... Actually, from the hotel side, there was a little bit initially of, we don't know if we can do this, you know, liability and all that. There was a little pushback, a little bit, like, should we do this? After they saw the Instagram page that we started climbing and over exceeding their own hotel accounts, I think they sort of thought this is more to it. And every day there's more to it. It's like you learn by doing. We've never done this before. I've never really done this before. People that say, you know, how did you train a dog in a hotel? Like, to use the bathroom outside around the corner and to do things, you know, to stay in the lobby. It's all a work in progress, so we're sort of learning as we go. But I know for me that she's changed the face of what the lobby is. People are you know, endlessly coming over to the concierge desk now asking, is she real? You know, like we get that all the time. We actually have a little sign on the desk that says, yes, I'm real, because they don't think she is. They'll be startled when she breathes or moves, and she thought she was a stuffed animal.
Yeah.
But she welcomes people. You know, if the line is busy, just send her out to troop around at the desk, and everybody slowly becomes distracted. I've had people tell me, I lost my dog recently, this has been so helpful for me, or I travel a lot and I don't get home as much as I like, and this is such a comfort. It's also wild to walk in from the hallway and hear people come off the elevator going, where's Millie? And you can hear them already asking about her, or hear discussions down in the restaurants downstairs or in the hallways in the back. You'll hear her name pop up and mention. The bellmen get very tired of it when we're not here because where's Millie? Where's Millie? So it's definitely gave the hotel a more like a place. It is a hotel, but for some people it's given them that little touch of home, so to speak, that it has an identity now more than just this big hotel between 5th and 6th Streets off of Wisconsin.
Well, and before Millie came on, you obviously had your job here. How does she help or hinder you in your duties, rather?
There are times, like, you wonder if you ever get anything done. I know it's sort of like a learning curve kind of thing, because I brought her in when she was like 10 weeks. So she had, you know, for a little bit at a time. So as she's learned more, there's less time, you know, training her to go to the bathroom outside, those kind of things. But there's still times when you're going, I really need to get some things done, and she's wandering somewhere or somebody spotted her down the hallway. So I work with, we have a trainer, Holly Lewis, who comes in. She actually comes into the hotel twice a month, and then we go to a class once a week that, you know, she's working with us to where can she be and where can she not be. And so it's enhanced my job in one sense, because it's people talk to me now constantly. You know, like before it was just like, oh, where's a restaurant? Now it's, what kind of dog? Where did this happen? And how did it, you know? And there's much more conversation going on at the desk now than there used to be.
Now, Dawn, you're an employee with the Hilton, right? So how has having Millie here at your work every day helped you and kind of changed your job or the atmosphere here in any way?
I think not only for myself, but a lot of my coworkers in the hotel, that she gives you a positive reason to want to come to work every day. You know, there's certain days, like she's off on Sundays and Mondays. I work Monday through Friday. So on Mondays, I'm like, oh, after the weekend, Millie's not here. You know, you kind of look forward to seeing her. You just, if you're passing by in the lobby on the way to the restroom or on the way to your lunch or in and out for the day, you stop and you see Millie and you're like, you just get that puppy kisses and some love. And it really makes your day just a lot more exciting at work. Or if you're having a bad day, you know, if you had an interaction with a coworker or a guest or just in general, just to get some puppy love is just, it makes anybody happy in the heart. So, yeah, and I love to spoil her. She gets all kinds of gifts, and I like to put clothes on her. So whenever she's wearing a shirt, it's usually from Aunt Dawn. So.
Now, you mentioned there was some kickback at first. Do you ever get any hesitant reactions from guests, or maybe if they're afraid of dogs or are afraid to approach her? How do you deal with that in the everyday?
Yeah, I mean, occasionally. I can only think of one time where someone mentioned after the fact that they were afraid to come in the lobby. A gentleman from that same group came down to me, and he knew who the person was. And after he met Millie, he went back to the person and said, you know, this dog, if you really want to get over the phobia, this is the dog to do it. Come down to the lobby. I mean, we have a little, behind the concierge desk, our carpenter Dave built a little, like, crate thing back there. So there's places for her to go if somebody was like, you know, I don't really want the dog around. But overall, no, it's more, can she come out of there now? Can she come out? Does she have to stay? Or she sits on the concierge desk a lot because when she was little, it was just a nice confining spot, but now she likes to sleep there a lot. And it's almost like a crate without a fence, mm-hmm. a gate on it. So she'll be up there occasionally, and people say, is she up here all the time? No. But it's just sometimes when it gets really busy and I can't keep my eyes on her all the time, you know, she'll peel off to another room, and there's a little bit of pandemic. Where is she? Where did she go? You know, we need her to have a tracking device or something so we know where
right.
she goes.
Could be a big place
yeah,
to get lost.
I know it is. She's got on the elevator. One guy was talking to her once, and I saw him disappear around the hallway, and then I saw Millie disappear, and I went down to the hallway. She wasn't there. And he said just as the door was closing, she jumped in with him to the elevator. And he had to ride up to 12 and bring her back down. So she does love the elevator. She loves riding the luggage carts. So anytime now she sees one, she thinks, oh, that's mine. And she jumps on and have a guest that's unhappy about something or needs something, and put her on the luggage cart and walk up to the room with her and open the door. It's totally dismissed. Whatever they were talking about, they totally forgot. And they let her run into the room and so.
A good way for you and other employees to alleviate the customer service stress a little
right.
bit.
Right, yes, it does help. It definitely does. It does.
What's your favorite part about bringing her with you most of the week?
You know, it's a different experience having had dogs all my life. And oftentimes people will come to the counter and say, what a cool thing to bring your dog with you to work every day. And I do think that is. But now it's different a little bit because it's a little more associated with the work aspect of it. And I still have to do my job. And there's a part of me that's jealous by the other employees that work here. Because when she sees them, she goes a little crazy. Like, I'm so happy to see you. Just like your dog would do if you were at work all day and you come home. Mm-hmm. Well, we don't get those interactions as much because we're always together. You know. But yeah, it's really nice having her. And I feel very fortunate to be able to bring my dog to work. And it's even more meaningful to see other people enjoy her too. It's not just like me with my dog. She's actually shared with hundreds of people. One lady asked me the other night how she's so spoiled to have all these people give her attention. But I sort of think of it in a different way. I mean, she gets hundreds of people that touch her and want to wake her up and do that every day. So she does sort of work hard when she's here. You know, it's not like just easy. She does have a job. So, but the nice thing is she does it so well. She really does. That was my biggest concern in finding a dog. How are we going to know we get the right temperament? Because this is really a specific thing we're asking to do. And she aced that over and above.
Do you think more workplaces should bring this idea? If not as a representative of the company, but at least having employees have their pets?
Yeah, I would say definitely. I mean, for employees, it's definitely changed, like Dawn was saying, the morale and people coming to work, and it just gives it a more sense of community amongst the employees. If another hotel wanted to replicate the idea, it would make sure you find the dog, don't rush into and then also you'd need a person that's going to really take it as a project and let them do the training and make sure she has an owner and a home and she has a life outside of the hotel. Yeah, I think you just have to do your research and, make sure you're in dog training classes. And, it's amazing how often people will come up and say, oh, no, it's okay. She's biting me. It's okay. No. It's not. Oh, it's okay. No, it's not. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly training even guests how to not. No, don't let her do that, please.
And, right. Now, Millie, I know you're busy chewing, but I have a question for you. Who's a good dog?
Oh,
she just there we go.
Well, Rusty and Millie, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me. It was a pleasure to see you.
Yeah, thank you. Come back anytime. See you.
Millie is a mini golden doodle and the canine concierge at the Hilton Milwaukee City Center. You can visit her Tuesday through Saturday at the hotel.
Rusty Daler is Millie's human, also a concierge at the Hilton. You can visit him Tuesday through Saturday as well, but we do not suggest scratching him behind his ears.
You can see pictures of Millie at work and find a link to her Instagram feed at WUWM.com.
Up next, an Illinois writer whose heart is in the north woods of Wisconsin shares an essay with us. Marnie Mominga joins us when Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Welcome back to Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Mitch Tyne.
And I'm Bonnie North. Writer Marnie Mominga is a Chicago area native, but many of her most touching words are written about her family's cabin in the North Woods of Wisconsin.
Mominga's latest book, On a Clear Night, is a collection of essays that includes reminiscences of her time in the North Woods along with the other parts of her life over the years. Here she is with one of those essays, Owner's Manual.
It was a dark and stormy night, or at least in my nightmares it seemed that way. Actually, it was a bright and sunny day when our tire blew out. If it had been a dark and stormy night, we would have really been in trouble. It was difficult enough trying to figure out how to assemble the jack, locate the spare, and find the axle in broad daylight. Current car commercials make one think that the technical engineering of our automobiles would put them right up there with the Mars spacecraft. Alas, somewhere along this high-tech pursuit, someone forgot about keeping the jack and spare tire instructions simple. After our recent experience, I'd put changing a tire right up there with solving a Rubik's Cube. Setting off on a 20-mile trip to town from our cabin on a beautiful fall day in northern Wisconsin, my husband and I heard a weird noise coming from the right side of our car, as if we were dragging a big stick. For once in our lives, we decided not to ignore a car sound we could not identify and stopped to take a look. To our surprise, the back right tire was flatter than a run-over penny on a train track. Turning the car around, we slowly drove the half mile back to the cabin where we would be able to change the tire on the garage floor's hard surface. At least we knew that much. Like a SWAT team, the two of us searched the car for the jack and spare tire to no avail. Finally, my husband discovered the jack, located in a cleverly camouflaged compartment beneath the second row seat. It consisted of four skinny pipes that looked like Tinkerbell's wand had been in a fight and lost. My husband and I looked at each other in dismay. How the heck did this contraption fit together, and where in the world did it jack up the car? It was time to pull out the owner's manual. Oh, the shame of it, the shame! What dignified, self-respecting person ever reads the owner's manual? And while I'm at it, whatever happened to the good old days when a jack was a jack? In our defense, we are not tire-changing neophytes. We changed our first tire together as dating teenagers on another deserted Wisconsin road in the middle of a forest with only the starlight to guide us. We found the escapade hilarious. My parents, understandably, did not. In addition, I am a veteran witness to tire changing, having grown up in the 1950s when my family of seven experienced a tire blowout on virtually every annual summer vacation to the North Woods and back that I can remember. Sooner or later, on our 450-mile odyssey, the familiar thumpity-thump-thump would resound through the open windows of our packed-to-the-brim station wagon with a canoe on top. With a few swears under his breath, my father would deftly pull the car to the side of an empty country road where a cluster of cows served as our only company. But we didn't panic. We had this tire-changing nailed, so to speak. Our biggest challenge was to untie the canoe from the top of the car and unload all the luggage and vacation paraphernalia from the back end of the station wagon in order to retrieve the jack and spare. Back then, even kids knew the spare tire's location. All jacks basically looked the same and always fit next to the wheel well. And no one needed an owner's manual to assemble them, nor was there one even if you'd wanted it. With a few good cranks of the jack, the car rose up faster than a phoenix out of the ashes. A couple of good twists of the wrench, and the bolts came flying off. On went the spare, back went the bolts, back went the belongings in the canoe, and we were back on the road in a matter of hours. Child's play. Unfortunately, the old adage, "Don't fix what ain't broken," got overlooked in the computer-age tire tune-up department. And so I have to admit, we opened the owner's manual to the index and looked up jack, page 342. In a flat and halting voice that sounded like Frankenstein's, I slowly read the instructions out loud to my husband. Assemble the jack and jacking tools as shown. Connect jack handle driver A to two extensions B, then to the lug wrench C. Now, ours is not a fancy car. It is a basic American-made model, a medium-sized SUV, but I'll be danged if we couldn't identify the axle where we were instructed to fit the jack because there was so much metal hanging beneath the carriage of the car. Before long, we two grandparents, college-educated with master's degrees, were slithering under the car on the sandy garage floor like a couple of snakes. "I think I found it," I shouted. "Look at this picture on page 344. It matches." We were so happy we thought we'd won the lottery. Luckily, in our search beneath the car, we also discovered the spare tire. What genius decided to hide it down there is beyond me, because our next quandary was how to disengage it. Back to the owner's manual, page 340. The spare tire is stowed under the rear of the vehicle by means of a cable winch mechanism. To remove or stow the spare, use the jack handle to rotate the spare tire drive nut. The nut is located under a plastic cover at the center rear of the cargo floor area, just inside the lift gate opening. There you have it. Easy as pie. As a bonus, there were enough caution warnings surrounding every direction that I felt I was entering Bill O'Reilly's no-spin zone. Somehow, we figured it out, and slowly, slowly, the spare tire floated down beneath the car like a spaceship twirling in an outer galaxy. Our sense of being in the twilight zone was complete. Eventually, we accomplished our task. The manual's parting note was to stow the tire beauty side up. This must have been an inside joke because, believe me, if there was a beauty side to the tire, I failed to recognize it. Gratefully, we were soon back on the road to town where the nice tire man informed us that our flat tire was ruined. When he replaced the spare a few days later, I watched in wonder as he whipped that tire off and put on the new one in a matter of minutes. Of course, he was using a power jack that would have shot our 2-ton car to the moon. I put one on my Christmas list. Yet, like all good nightmares, mine was not over. Recently, I bought a car seat for my 2 infant granddaughters, and a few mind-boggling attempts to connect it properly, I was beginning to think the tire changing looked easy. As frustrated as a 2-year-old and in fear of going ballistic, I once again succumbed to the instruction manual. Imagine my horror when I read, "Check vehicle owner's manual for the vehicle top tether anchor locations. They may be identified using one of the anchor's symbols, figure B or figure C. Pass the Tylenol."
Marnie Mominga reading her essay, Owner's Manual. It's taken from her latest book called On a Clear Night, Essays from the Heartland. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press.
We'll take one more break, and then it's time for our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Three, two, one.
Welcome to Ex Fabula!
True personal story.
Ex Fabula!
Ex Fabula is a Milwaukee nonprofit committed to strengthening community bonds through the art of storytelling.
Time for another edition of Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend. So great to have Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney in the studio again. Hello.
Hello again. How goes it?
It's going great. Yeah, good. Middle of summer, as we've said, it's just such a great time to be in Milwaukee. Plenty of time for lots of great adventures.
Oh, yes, indeed. That just kind of brings us really quickly right to our theme for this week of stories, which is Don't Try This at Home. We have a lot of interesting stories in our canon about people who have really pushed the limits of like adrenaline fixes and, you know, just putting themselves out in the line. And this week's stories are a little bit more centered at home. So we're going to get into those in a little bit. I have to ask you, do you have any daredevil stories you want to share?
I don't want to get too gross, but one of them involved losing a toenail.
All right.
Biking, and when the brakes didn't work, had to use the foot, and flip-flops and biking and pavement don't all go together. So
yeah, mine's kind of similar. I was living in Park Slope, slope being the key word in that sentence, Brooklyn, and I got a new pair of rollerblades. And decided I wanted to start rollerblading to work in the morning. So one morning, 4:30 in the morning, I put my skates on and I start going downhill and velocity takes over and there's no grass in Brooklyn for the most part. So I ended up smashing up against a light pole just to stop myself from like going into oncoming traffic.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so, that was a heck of a way to wake up at 4:30 in the morning.
How did the light pole fare then?
Oh, who cares?
Yeah. Jeez, that sounds like that could have had a much more tragic ending to it. Yeah.
So before we get into the stories, I do have an announcement. We have exciting news. We are bringing back the Equal Access Project, which we're so excited to announce because this is the second year that we're doing this. And it aims to amplify the voices and stories of individuals with disabilities. And I will be happy to get into more details about that in a couple minutes. But, you know, why keep people in suspense? Let's get on with the stories.
Indeed. So first up, another one involving a bike.
Yes. This story is from Bill Stevens, who first told it in February of 2016 at our Story Slam, which was themed Fatherhood. Here's Bill Stevens.
This story is not about my father, and it's not about my two sons. It's about some 10-year-old kid that I met one time. Didn't know him, haven't seen him since, but I had the opportunity to pass along some fatherly advice, some wisdom that I had gained somewhere before then. I would pass along to this little kid. Had to do with riding a bike, which I do around my neighborhood. And I have at least three bad habits when riding a bike. I don't wear a helmet generally. I learned to ride a bike before helmets were invented. Helmets didn't make sense to me. All right, I'm old school. Second, I rarely touch the handlebars with my hands. I can ride without doing that. Roads are straight and flat, not too tough. Third thing I do, whenever I see kids playing in the street, I'll ride by and I say, "Hey, throw me it, I'm open." And then they generally look at each other and run up the driveway and say, "Stranger danger." And I pedal off before the mom can come out and look for the perp that's talking to their kids. And there was one time I was riding along and I see a young kid playing catch with his dad, throwing the football back and forth. And I ride by and say, "Hey, throw me the ball, I'm open." And at that point, the world hit slow motion because I saw the kid throw the ball to his dad. His dad grabbed the ball without looking, spun it in his hands, looking for the laces. He took a 5-step drop, knowing he's going deep. And right then, I could tell he'd played quarterback somewhere, probably like an SEC school, you know, Ole Miss or Auburn. Had those two first names like Billy Ray or Bobby Joe. So he grabs a ball and he flings it and he had a tight spiral, quick release, and the ball heads up into the trees and it's gone for a second or two and then it comes down from the trees and I'm pedaling along and the first thing I think of is that I can catch this. And I'm pedaling and right as I reach out and I stretch my hands out and I see all 8 fingers touch the ball as the ball slides through my fingers, and at just that moment, my front tire, all by itself, takes a 90-degree turn, and the bike and I head up some guy's driveway and run smack dab into the back of his car. The bike stops where it is. I do not. I went flying off the bike, and I landed on either my handlebars or the trunk of the car, or both. And as bad as the dismount was, I stuck the landing because I think I was in the fetal position before I even touched the ground, and I landed in a lump right in the middle of the lawn. And I sat there for a second, and then I heard footsteps, and I heard somebody yell, "He just rode into a parked car." And I know this is not good. So I look out of one eye, and I see the kid and the dad are now leaning over me. And I saw this as a teaching moment. I said, "Kid, I was so stupid. Do not do what I did. You know, I was an idiot. You got to learn from my mistake here." Then I look at the dad, and I say, "Pal, I am so sorry. It was the perfect toss. It was a touchdown all the way. I should have had it. It was all my fault." And then the mom comes running up, and I go, "Really?" To add to my humiliation. She says, "Oh, mister, are you okay?" And I said, yeah, I think so. I think I'll be leaving now. And I could barely get out of my crouch, and I get on the bike, grab the handlebar with both hands, and I pedal away, vowing that I'll never do something so stupid in my life as I just did. And to this day, I have broken that vow only a couple dozen times, so I think I'm good. Thank you very much.
And that was Bill Stevens with his "Look, Mom, No Hands" bike story.
If you feel like you're in the Tour de France when you can ride your bike with no hands, yes. But yeah, inevitably something like that is going to go wrong.
Yes. Well, here's some stuff that's going right. We did speak a little bit about our Equal Access Project that's coming back. Throughout the first year that we did this, we had many successes with it and learning opportunities. Like, did you know that there are only a handful of wheelchair accessible stages in the Milwaukee area? I mean, we're always looking out and trying to embed ourselves. So the Equal Access Project helped us understand that. And so the project, in partnership with various disability-focused organizations, really bring these issues to light while creating an inclusive and accessible environment for all. So, you know, our mission to strengthen community bonds through the art of storytelling. We are also working within the framework of recognizing the need to marry technology with accessibility. Like, for instance, attendees at the SLAMs can now access voting ballots and programs in Braille. Volunteers also work to caption YouTube videos, transcribe audio on the Xfabula website, and assist guests at Story Slams. So if you want to learn more about the Equal Access Project, you just like us on Facebook, of course, sign up for the Xfabula mailing list, and look out for future storytelling workshops and programming that's going to start in fall, which, by the way, right around the corner.
Oh, don't want to think about it. Want to stay in summertime. But what a cool project.
Yeah. It's been really successful, and we just want to keep moving in that direction. So,
fantastic. Speaking of moving in a particular direction,
yes,
we're going to take a walk off the beaten path right now.
Yes, we will. This story is from Christian Mattson Alvarez, who enjoys walking around our fair city. So let's listen to his story that was originally told at an Oops Story Slam.
So I don't know if you guys have gotten coffee around here. You might have seen some flyers I put up. Bruce City Safari, you guys seen that before? Yeah? All right. I run Bruce City Safari, and I started that out with, when I 3 years ago, I had no money. I was broke. I was getting divorced. I was getting my house foreclosed on me. And you know what? I wanted to go for a walk. So I started going for these walks, like 8-9 miles, something like that. And people started wanting to come with me. So I said, yeah, fine, come on. I'm a big believer in personal freedom. You want to come with? That's fine. I don't care. Whatever. And I like to point out this is a cautionary tale for all you about not playing on the train tracks. So let's just table that for once. So I grew up on the East Coast. I love graffiti. I love seeing it everywhere. You see graffiti on train tracks, right? So I figure, you know what? Let's bring a bunch of people down to the train tracks, huh? So I have a friend of mine. And I really hope she doesn't hear this, because I tell this every single time. It's like my best story about my hikes. And every single time I tell it, it's kind of embarrassing for her, because this one hike, she decided to bring her 9-year-old kid. And I was like, nah, don't bring your kid with. It's not going to really be safe for the kid. But I'm, again, personal freedom. You're a parent. You make the decision. That's fine. Bring the kid. So I meet up about 6-7 people in an Arby's parking lot. There's a bridge. We're going to scale down. It's probably about a 20-foot drop. No big deal. It's September, too, and it starts downpouring. We're talking like monsoon season. You're getting drenched, all that stuff. And we got to slide down this incline, and it's a muddy hill. And in order to slide down, you got to scoot down on your butt. Mud plus your butt. So we're all walking down these train tracks like we had, like, the most explosive diarrhea you can ever think of. So as we're walking on the train tracks, I tell everybody, you know what? We're on these train tracks. Let's try to be safe. So let's try to walk into the side of the train tracks instead of on the train tracks. And people, for the most part, you know, they do that until probably about 5 minutes in. They say, oh, train tracks. Let's walk on it. Stand by me. All right. We start going down the train tracks, and we come across, they're like these ruins, these really cool-looking ruins. There's graffiti all over them. It looks really cool and mysterious and stuff. And her son starts running up ahead. That's fine. He's playing. We're looking behind us, looking ahead of us. No train's coming. Sure, you can go ahead and play. That's fine. So he darts up this hill, and like probably about like, I don't know, maybe like 30 seconds after he goes up the hill, he comes running back down the hill. And following right behind him is the mother from the Goonies, Mama Fratelli. And she's got a can of Beast Ice in her hand, and she's missing all her teeth. And she's chasing this kid out down the hill, and he's like running behind me, because 7 foot tall guy, and there's this toothless meth head in front of me, and she's like screaming at like, hey, why is that kid going up here? You better not be setting any more fires up here. There's six adults and a kid here. Are we taking this kid out to set fires to homeless people's camps or something? And I'm trying to get in between. Like, look, we're going for a walk here. We're not trying to like set fire to your stuff or anything. And she's like trying to like get him between me and like all these adults right here. So finally we're like, all right, let's just be cool. Let's go our separate ways. You go that way, I'll go this way. So we continue further down the train tracks. By the way, it's downpouring the entire time, too. Did I mention that? Yeah, it's still downpouring right here. We have to stop every, like, probably, like, 10 minutes or so and hide under a bridge so we don't get drenched. So we keep going on. We see gang signs and stuff, you know, Latin Kings, all that stuff. But anyway, so eventually we have to turn around, and we have to go back by where she was. And then when we finally, like, we have to sneakily go by where she is, and then we have to go back up that 20-foot hill. And then when we finally get past that 20-foot hill, we walk through a construction site. And when we get out of the construction site, there's a big sign behind us that says, this is federal property, you can't walk through here, blah, blah, blah. You could get arrested, blah, blah, blah. And there's two construction guys just looking at us, and all we can do is just wave. Oops.
And that was Christian Mattson Alvarez with his oops story that he told back in 2015, which is, don't try this at home.
And I just love that pouring rain to boot. That reminds me of a lot of my walks growing up where I'd take a walk in the woods and then I'd end up in someone's driveway. And it would be like, whoa, how did I get here? But, yeah. You know, I just love exploring places that you think you know, but you don't really know them until you check every little trail and every little alley that there is out there.
Yeah, I was just talking to somebody about like urban walking as opposed to nature walking. I think a lot of people would choose to do nature hiking and walking, but I've always been an urban walker. So I live in Bayview and I have a tendency just if I need to get my shoes on and start going, I'll go straight down KK and I'll go up to the east side or even further sometimes, knowing that I could always just take a bus home or something. I just like the action.
Well, this has been another fast episode. Well, it's been great getting to know our city a little bit better. And once again, the disclaimer, don't try this at home, kids.
Yes, so true, so true. Thanks so much for having me, Rachel.
Thanks again, Leah. See you next week.
Okay.
Ex-Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Weekend All Things Considered comes your way next. It's 4 o'clock.